The American Homebrewers Association, which turns 40 this year, is offering a free book with every membership gift card purchase made during November and December. Head over to homebrewersassociation.org to see the free book options and learn more about the benefits of AHA membership. Spoiler, the books are awesome and the benefits are abundant. Head over to homebrewersassociation.org to see for yourself. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, November 8th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, editor of BeerAndWineJournal.com, waxes on and off about competition karate, or his take on how you can take home more medals from homebrewing contests. If you go to BasicBrewing.com, you can find archives or our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you do us a favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that will help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's done so. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. There are bonus videos on there that nobody else sees other than people who support us financially. Steve and I are set to get together later this week to record a bunch of stuff for the audio and video sides of things. We've both had a ton of stuff going on in our personal lives, so whenever we can get together, we try to make the most of our time. On the docket this week that we're going to record are a hop sampler audio show, video shows on Mockoli, a delicious no-hoppy or no-boil, plenty hoppy, but no-boil hoppy hazy extract beer, the temperature experiment using Imperial's low-key yeast, lots of stuff. And if we appear extra silly during any of those shows, you'll know why. And speaking of our sponsor, Imperial Organic Yeast, their seasonal strain A43 low-key is available until the end of November. You might find it a little bit after that, but look for it now. Low-key is a traditional Norwegian strain that has an extremely wide fermentation temperature range. The strain has been traditionally used in farmhouse-style beers. However, due to its fermentation range, it can be used in a variety of beers, from pseudo-lagers, Belgian-inspired beers, and hop-forward beers. On the cool end of the range, low-key is super clean, producing little to no esters and phenols. But as things warm up, it tends to produce a huge fruit ester profile. And Casey from Imperial says she gets tons of peach when it's fermented warm. The temperature range, 65 degrees Fahrenheit to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 18 to 38 C. Flocculation, medium to high. Attenuation is 75 to 85%. Now, I brewed a split batch of beer with low-key, fermenting half at 68 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 20 C, down in the basement, and the other half at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 32 C, in my high-gravity system, using it as a sous vide thing. I don't want to spoil it too much, but the beers are different. They're both tasty beers, but it's always fun to play with the variables using the same ingredients to see what changes come about. So I sent some bottles to the folks at Imperial, so look forward to an episode about the experiment in the future. And look for A43 Low-key at your Imperial or your homebrew shop or Steve's Brew Shop and High Gravity as well. They both carry Imperial organic yeast. Love this stuff. I'm still getting email about Mockoli from the episode, you know, a few episodes back. This one comes from Daniel in San Francisco. Daniel says, I travel to Korea quite often for work, but had never heard of Mockoli until your Basic Brewing Radio episode. Lucky for me, that episode came out right before my most recent trip to Korea. I asked several of my Korean colleagues about it. Farmer's drink is an accurate description, and was able to easily find it at most places we went for dinner. Daniel says the makgeolli I ordered was 6% ABV and reminded me of a sweet, milky Hefeweizen with tons of banana aroma and flavor, with only a hint of sourness that grew as it warmed up. Goes great with kimchi. Well, I bet. Daniel says, if you'd like to make another Korean-focused episode, somaek, I'm probably mispronouncing that, is a common drink that I've had many times with Korean co-workers. It's a cocktail of a light lager and soju mixed to taste at the table and then slammed in rapid succession with your dinner mates. Daniel says, not a great use of homebrew. Thanks, Daniel. I looked it up. Soju is another Korean beverage, according to the interwebs. Soju is distilled and can apparently be quite powerful. So that sounds like a headache waiting to happen. Appreciate that, Daniel. If you want to take the headache out of brewing, how's that segue? Check out our sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. The folks at High Gravity are electric brewing experts. They even use an electric system for their tap room, Pippin's Tap Room, which is attached to the homebrew store. High Gravity has a wide variety of turnkey electric systems to choose from, starting at single-vessel brew-in-a-bag systems, like Steve and I have, to two-vessel systems and even three-vessel systems, both Herms and Rims. And they all come paired with Warthog controllers that match their functions. And if you're more handy than I am, you can just order a Warthog controller standalone and build your own system. Maybe you want to retrofit what you've got already and turn it into electric gear. Me? I just let Dave build mine because I want it to work. And it does. Boy, it's the system has worked flawlessly since I got it. And I really enjoy brewing with my electric gear from High Gravity. Take the pain out of propane and use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your electric gear at highgravitybrew.com. And tell Santa that we sent you. Hey, before I forget it again, don't forget to send in your brewing disaster stories. The end of the year will be upon us before we know it. And I don't know what the prizes will be this year yet. And I don't know when we're going to record. So get those stories in. It's always fun to hear your stories of brewing going wrong and then sometimes going right afterwards. So send those to me, James at basicbrewing.com. Get your brewing disaster stories in. Okay, let's talk to Chris Colby, editor of BeerAndWineJournal.com, about how to increase your chances in homebrewing competitions. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
You got, what, a five-part series going on BeerAndWineJournal.com?
Yeah. Yep.
And we're talking about competitions, and we've talked about competitions before on the show, but it's been a while, and we haven't had your take on them. And you're taking a kind of a martial arts kind of an approach to the topic.
Yeah, I called the first one Contest Karate, just, I don't know, for a catchy name. But then the metaphor sort of slid around during the series. I went to from that to Sun Tzu's Art of War, then somehow to ninjas, and then it eventually got back to karate. But yeah, that's the sort of metaphor, the sort of half-assed metaphor that I try to use throughout.
So where do we start? I mean, it's a big topic. First of all, why should people submit their beers to competitions? Why should they go to the trouble?
Well, that's purely up to the person. If you, if you enjoy competition and you want to, I mean, you're supporting whatever, homebrew club that you, send your entries to, cause you know, you have to pay for, contest entry, but really, it just boils down to some brewers want to make it, competitive, and, that's, you know, a lot of people have fun making everything competitive, you know. Well, yeah, I mean, I was in marching band in high school, and then we practiced a lot so that we could be a better marching band than everyone else. And, you know, somehow that did it for us. but yeah, that's basically competition. Like if you're just worried about getting a better brewer and quality, there's no real reason to enter a homebrew contest, because you're not going to find out, you know. You're just going to get back a sheet that says either not to style or, you know, something. But yeah, so it's entering competition is just for the sake of competition.
Well, sometimes you can get some good feedback from judges. You know, on the few times that I've judged competitions, I tried to give some kind of useful feedback rather than this is good or this is bad or this is not to style. So, you know, what about that?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I judge a lot of contests and I try to give good feedback. But, I mean, I've also, back in the day, entered enough contests to know that good feedback is not the average response. You know, occasionally you get something pretty good, but usually it's the beer will either be not to style or to style, or, you know, occasionally there'll be a few more hints, but they'll largely be style-based rather than quality-based is my experience.
So let's start out on the tips. You say first of all, to win competitions or to place well in competitions and get medals and ribbons and things like that, you got to be a good brewer.
Yeah. I started with the obvious, because if I left it off, people would say, oh, you have to actually brew good beer. So I point out you do need to brew good beer. All the tips I have in this series of articles aren't going to help you if you can't brew beer that's basically fault-free. You know, it can't have diacetyl in it. It can't have, you know, that Band-Aid-y phenolic taste. It can't be stale, you know, oxidized. You know, it's got to be basically fault-free beer, and you need to first become a good enough brewer to produce that. And I mean, I didn't go into it in the article, but I'd say that the big three things in making the best beer is getting your pitching rate right, getting your fermentation temperature right, and aerating the wort adequately before you pitch. You know, everything else counts too, but I think those things are what distinguish between what's the best homebrew and what's the worst homebrew.
And if you submit something that's got significant flaws, you're not going to medal.
Yeah.
unless you get really bad judges, and then but you can't.
Yeah. I mean, you have to figure out that there are a lot of homebrewers who are competitive and enter, and therefore they enter multiple competitions. So almost any competition you enter, you're going to be going up against someone whose goal it is to win medals and has done this before. And, you know, they're not wasting their time entering substandard beer. So, you know, you gotta be ready when you step into the ring.
So another way to enter to win more stuff is to enter more beers.
Yeah. I mean, that again is the obvious, you know, you can't win if you're not in. And later on, I tie that into sort of what things to, you know, what categories to enter. But yeah, you should, the converse of, you know, you need to brew beer and everything has to be good, is that in a contest, there's sort of the breaks, you know, and the breaks can go your way or they can go, you know, against you. And because, I mean, back when I used to enter contests, it used to, at least the first couple of years, it surprised me, because I'd enter, you know, maybe five beers. And I thought, like, two of these are really good, one of them is pretty good, and these other two, I'm just, you know, entering, you know, to give the homebrew club $5 or whatever the entry fee was at the time. And, you know, I would get back the results, and they would not, you know, frequently they would not match at all with my assessment of the beers. and then, you know, I'd send them to another contest, and they would again not mesh with what I thought, but they would also not mesh with what, you know, the results of the other contest. So there's a healthy amount of, well, depending on how I think about it, there's a healthy amount of variation there. So don't, like, if you've got five beers and you're like, these two are pretty good, and, you know, these three are not quite as good, but they're still decent, enter them all, because, you know, the breaks could go for you that day.
And the National Homebrew Competition, it's gotten so popular and so big that they've got limits on how many beers that you can enter nowadays. But yeah. Smaller competitions don't have that constriction, right?
Smaller competitions want your money. Yeah. So they will take however many. Yeah. And you know, that you're helping them out, they help you out, you know, good thing. But yeah, in the larger competitions, the entry limits are just basically to keep, Mark Shoppy, who's a guy in our club, from flooding the contest and winning it every year. but secondarily, just a logistics thing that the entry numbers go up and up and up. But yeah, most competitions will take any amount of entries. And so if you've got beer brewed and it's, you know, if you think at all this has, you know, at all of a shot, even if it's a shot of like the Cleveland Browns playing the LA Rams, you know, even that kind of shot, enter it. And go Browns, by the way.
So this is going to run in a couple of weeks. So I don't know if that
they're just in the rebuilding decade. That's all.
Like the Arkansas Razorbacks. Every year it's a building year.
Yeah.
Let's pay off another coach a few million dollars to go away. Anyway, that's what were you talking about?
Sports chat. Connected it. You're on the line. What do you have to say?
Yeah, line one. Turn off your radio. Okay, so you have more experience in judging than I do, but even in my limited experience in judging, palate fatigue is an issue. And if you're judging a big long flight of beers, you know, there's some variation, you know, depending on which beer that you taste first, and which beer that you taste last. And anybody who's had a series of say, oh, big hoppy beers over an evening, you know, at home or at a pub or whatever, knows that your palate gets tired after a while. And that beer that you normally think is way hoppy and fresh and fruity and all that, you know, after you've had a few similar beers, it doesn't taste as good maybe, or at least it tastes different. So as a competition participant or entrant, how do you combat that when you are sending your beer in to be judged by a panel?
Yeah, one of the best pieces of advice in my article I have is to make sure that your beer is going to stand out in the flight. You know, what I make the point that you just made in, you know, if you're tasting in a flight of IPAs, if the average IBU is like 70 IBUs, if you submit one with 60 IBUs, it's going to taste like less hoppy than a pale ale. You know, it's just going to get washed out. So think about the beer, you know, the style, and think about how is your beer going to stand out in a flight of similar beers. And later on in the series of articles, I even tell people, like, pour your homebrew into a glass, but take several other examples, you know, even if you have to go on my commercial examples, and taste it all side by side. That's going to give you a big hint about how yours does in competition, because, you know, the judge isn't, you know, he doesn't show up, like drink a full glass of your beer over a half hour and then write comments. He's got, you know, 7 to 9 or however many in the flight to, you know, one taste, one taste, one taste, one taste. And they've all got, you know, or they all should have basically the same flavor characteristics if they're all, you know, the same style. So yours has to stand out in a lineup of beers with the same characteristics. And so the obvious way to do that is figure out what's the key element in the style and overdo that just a little, just enough to make it stand out, but not enough to make it, you know, obviously into a different category.
So a style that is, say, you know, bready or biscuity or something like that, as a characteristic of the style, you might bump that up a little more than you normally do and make something that you wouldn't necessarily brew as a beer that you'd be drinking on normally?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, the kind of beers that win in contests, you know, they don't drink enough of your beer to find out if it's something that you can have a couple pints of. They drink enough, just, you know, the judges drink just enough in a lineup of other beers similar and taste, you know, oh, this tastes pretty good, this tastes pretty good. You know, and what normally tastes pretty good is the whatever character of the beer that's important, that has to shine through. If they have to go hunting for it, well, then they'll say, you know, your hop character is lacking. I entered a pale ale once that was a clone of Sierra Nevada, and I followed the sort of standard Sierra Nevada clone recipe, and I brewed it, and I tasted it next to Sierra Nevada, and then the one fault I thought was that, oh, this is, it's too hoppy. People are going to think it's an IPA. But I sent it to a homebrew contest, and then the comment I got was, where's the hops? You know, and I was told to read Charlie Papazian's book. So you needed to add hops to beer. And I was like, oh, okay. And then that was the beginning of the decline in my interest in entering contests.
So So another tip is maybe to, if you know that you're good at brewing something, keep entering that something, right?
Yeah, that's again, that's from the obvious files. Like if you brew, let's say you have an IPA and you win a medal with it. Okay, IPA is a very competitive category. If you won the medal with that recipe once, you know, the categories don't change year after year. It's the same description. Yeah, go with brew to your strengths, definitely. And if you enter contests, you know, very frequently, you'll probably end up with a series. You know, you could call it a portfolio of, you know, here's my winning recipes. And, you know, I know on the one hand, one of the great things about being a home brewer is you can brew something new every batch. And there are people who enter contests, and every year is a different bunch of beers. And that's fine. You know, it's whatever you want to do. But, I mean, if you're serious about, you know, the main thing I'm doing with brewing these beers is to win at a contest, then, yeah, definitely, you know, if you've got a proven winner, go with it.
And some of these, you say some of these competitions are linked together in sort of a circuit of like kind of like a racing, you know, NASCAR circuit. You have competitions that are linked together and or like a point-based thing?
Yeah. For example, there's the Lone Star Circuit here in Texas, where you can enter the Blue Bonnet and the one in Houston and the Foam Rangers, the Dixie Cup, and the, I forget what the other one is, the Masternauts, and I think even our Austin one is now in that circuit, although we're not a BJCP contest, and you know, there's the other ones, and they give a prize for the cumulative number of points over the you know, all the different contests. So that encourages people to enter, you know, the people who really want to go after that, you know, encourages to enter every single contest because you score points for every medal you get. And that, you know, I guess that drives people to brew more, to enter contests. And it helps out every club in the circuit too, because you know, you automatically bump your amount of entrance. So yeah, that's, you know, another aspect of the competition, and it's one in the article I tie it into your brewing planning, like, because contests tend to be clustered in time. They're not evenly spread out across the whole year. So when there's a cluster of contests, you can just backpedal from, you know, okay, if the entry deadline is here, I have to brew this beer by here, you know, I have to brew this one by here, because different beers take longer to condition. Just figure out, you know, generally brew the stronger, like either lagers or the stronger ales first, because they take longer to come into condition, and then brew the, you know, more session ales last, and then sort of, you know, a week or two before the entry date, get them all packaged, get them all, you know, have them sit somewhere, and look for, as we talked about earlier, look for an opportunity in the weather to send when, you know, there's not a heat wave, so that your entries are baking in the back of a UPS truck.
Yeah, we were talking about that before I hit the record button, Steve and I received a shipment from a home brewer that we know, we know that he brews good beverages, and we got, five bottles, I think, in the middle of the summertime, and it turned out that the hot weather, you know, the hot loading dock at UPS, the hot truck, you know, a cascading condition of hotness actually did some damage to the flavor of the beer, of the beverages. And so, and we talked to the guy, and he was like, oh, they tasted good when they left here. And then he actually heat stressed some similar bottles, and they came up with that same flaw. So even, you know, a short period of time in a very extreme weather circumstance can you know, damage the flavor and character of your brews. So maybe, you know, take some steps to protect them.
In our club, which is based in Austin, for the Dallas, usually for the Dallas and usually for the Houston competitions, and sometimes for the San Antonio one, there'll be someone from our club who volunteers to drive all the beers there. Like, you just get your beer to him, before he takes off, and they drive it and personally deliver it, and they'll take good care of that. The thing you never know, though, is how the competition is going to take care of it. You know, mm-hmm. you might have your beer delivered, and then it might sit in a hot warehouse. But then, if that's the case, everyone's beer is sat in that same hot warehouse. But
you know, let's hope that being good beer people, that they know, you know, how to handle good beer.
Yeah, I think it's usually when something like that happens, it's not a lack of knowledge. It's just a lack of being able to round up cooler space somewhere. You know, if you're lucky, there's a craft brewer somewhere near you who, you know, has some space and is willing to host, you know, your competition's beer or you know, somebody in the beer industry somehow, and you say, look, we've got to store our entries for, you know, the entry window is this long and we need to store them for that period. So yeah, hopefully the beer is stored well at the competition. And, you know, I know for a fact that some it's handled very well, but I also sort of know for a fact that others, that sometimes circumstances lead to substandard storage. So it's part of the game.
You were talking about the brewing plan. If you have to brew a certain beer, say like an IPA that you want to be nice and fresh, you don't necessarily have to brew 5 or 10 gallons of that beer. You can brew smaller batches. That way you can brew it more often and not have to have the expense of having brewed big batches or the, you know, not so much of a problem, but the issue of having lots of good beer around.
Yeah.
You can brew smaller.
Yeah, I remember at one point in my club, someone asked Mark Shoppy, like, how do you brew that much beer? You know, you must have bottles everywhere. And I mean, he did, because he used to, you know, back when contests was unlimited, he used to enter just tons and tons at every contest. But he was like, oh, I don't brew 5 gallons of anything at a time. You know, he brewed 1 or 2 gallons. And you can, you know, depending on how much beer you're going to brew overall, both contest entries and just stuff for yourself, and, you know, how much beer you plan to use, including, you know, for your own consumption, your family's consumption, friends, homebrew club, you know, you can sort of figure on what scale you brew at. As long as you can, you know, if you could brew something good at 5 gallons, you should be able to brew at the same quality with 3 or 2 using pretty much basically your same set of equipment. Just if you get a smaller, like a 3 gallon or a 2 gallon carboy, for if you do secondary, that's all you need. And you can also, if you're trying to brew and you're like on a budget, obviously smaller batch sizes are going to help, because every batch is also going to cost multiple contest entry fees. But you can save money by, instead of having, a bunch of expensive fermenters, just have a fleet of buckets that are, especially if you find smaller ones.
Or even 1 gallon jugs. I mean, if you want to do some obscure style, that you might not even necessarily like yourself, that maybe has some weird techniques or something like that, you can brew even, like 1 gallon batches and still have enough to send into a competition.
Yeah, exactly. You can, because most competitions are 2 bottles or 3 bottles is all they ask. So you can, if you're going to try to enter for a whole circuit, you might need to bump it up to 2 or 3 gallons. And then that's basically your contest entries are going to be, other than maybe a test beer for you at some point, are all that you ever end up drinking of it. So you've got to, you take your own consumption into account.
And I mentioned obscure styles. That may be another key to getting more medals or ribbons, is to enter the style categories that you may have a better chance of winning because there are fewer entrants. Like, winning a medal in a major contest in the IPA category is going to be tough. But, something more obscure, more difficult to brew, you probably have a better chance of winning something because there aren't going to be very many people doing that one.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of contests, or at least a fair amount of contests, will somewhere have statistics on like how many beers were entered in each category each year. And, sometimes it's on their website, or sometimes they announce it with the, along with the results. Or sometimes if they don't, you can just call whoever the contest coordinator that year to say, I'm interested in what people are entering. And you can find the categories that aren't being entered a lot. In a lot of smaller contests, basically entering in a category, you can, in some cases, guarantees you a first, second, or third, because if they want to get 3 entries, and if you're, again, if your goal is, I want medals, that's the thing you want, then that's an easy choice. But even in categories that have, more entries, not everything medals, if you're brewing good beer and you're approaching the contest intelligently, like especially, thinking about how is your beer going to stand out in a crowd of similar beers. If you taste your beer, in a crowd of similar, commercial beers and take good notes and say, what I should, what I need to do to make mine stand out against these beers is this. You still got a pretty good shot in the fewer beers there are in a category.
And you said that one thing that that makes a beer stand out in a flight is carbonation level as well.
Yeah, that's the last installment that I'm going to post today, although this will be in the past by the time this comes out. One thing I've noticed is that, every bottle you get at a contest, you'll look on the bottom to see if there's yeast sediment, and it'll tell you if it's, bottle conditioned or packaged out of a keg. And a lot of the beers at multiple competitions that I've judged in the past few years that come out of the bottles that have clearly been keg bottled, are lacking in carbonation. And so, I'd say really make an effort, if you're in it to win it, as they might say. Increasing your carbonation level to at least what it should be is going to help your beer stand out. It's going to help your foam stand, which is part of the appearance. You know, it's going to help, just the flavor of the beer. And also, if your beer is good, a lot of times when a judge gets done with a flight of beers, he says to the other judge, "What are our best three?" And they'll look at their scores. But sometimes they'll say, "Let's retaste the best, you know, three or four, and just to confirm what we want, or just to make sure, have we got one, two, and three right?" And, you know, because sometimes there'll be arguments like, "Well, I like this one better." You know, if your carbonation level is higher, it's going to survive a little bit better to that point where the final decision is being made at the table. You know, because, you know, sometimes judges will just retaste from the beer that was already poured, or sometimes, you know, they'll take the bottle and pour a new sample, but, you know, they're not going to go open that second bottle just at the table to do it. So, the one concrete piece of advice that I give in the series is, carbonate your beer at least to the level it should be, if not slightly more, not so much more that it's, you know, noticeably and they can knock you on the style, but enough that that it's carbonated well. You know, most craft beer is carbonated every bit as much as American Pilsners are, and people are used to that at brew pubs, at when they buy craft beer or whatever. So they're not, even in styles where technically the carbonation, you know, quote unquote, should be lower, people are used to drinking craft beers where it's at the normal level that, you know, American consumers like. So you're unlikely to get dinged for over carbonating a beer unless the beer hits the ceiling when you open, you know, when you open the bottle. And that I think is the sort of, if I had to give one single point recommendation, it would be that carbonation.
Is that your stomach or a cat that's growling?
That's a cat that's growling. it's sleeping here, and it's sleep growling.
So what are the keys if you keg your beer and you want to send a beer from the keg to the competition? What are the keys to effectively transferring a beer to the bottle and maintaining proper carbonation?
Well, there's a couple ways. There's the quick fill, which I suspect a lot of people are using in the competitions that I've gone to, just because the beer is less carbonated enough that it. But the secondary way and the better way is to use a counter pressure bottle filler, and this is a piece of equipment where you hook it up to the bottle, and the filler is connected to your CO2 tank and also your keg, and you start off by blowing CO2 into the bottle, which evacuates the air from it. Then you stop doing that. Then you turn on the beer, and the bottle is already slightly pressurized from the CO2, and so you need just slightly more pressure to force the beer into the bottle, and it fills, and then you pull the filler off quickly and cap, and that retains most of the carbonation. If you know you're going to be bottling for a contest, and let's say your beer is carbonated like to perfection, it's like this is the right level. If you know the next day you're going to be bottling some, turn up the gas pressure just a little bit, like 1 or 2 psi, and actually 2 psi is probably too much, 1 psi, and just over carbonate the beer slightly, because with the counter pressure filler, when you take off the filler, the time between that being pulled off and the cap getting crimped on, you're losing pressure at that point. So just compensate by slightly over carbonating your beer, and then you'll be great. And even without it, a counter pressure fill, even if you don't bother to over carbonate the beer, is still going to be much better than, you know, some people will chill down the bottle and they'll take like a Cobra tap and put a uh, Tygon tubing on it, so it reaches the bottom of the bottle and just sort of quickly fill and cap. And that works, you know, reasonably well, but you do lose a noticeable amount of carbonation that way.
What I do is I chill the bottle, and then I turn off the pressure to the keg, and I release all the pressure from the keg, and then barely let in more enough pressure to barely push the beer into the bottle, you know, and very slowly and patiently fill the bottle. And I think that does okay. You know, it's not as good as a counter pressure bottle filler, but you know, usually I'm only doing like one or two bottles at a time, and I'm not going to go to all the trouble to set something like that. And I don't have one, so so you know, maybe that's a better way to do it than just, you know, quickly. It seems like to me if you quickly fill a bottle, you know, number one, you're going to have foam issues, and then number two, you're going to be knocking some of the carbonation out too.
Yeah, and those two are related. Obviously, if you fill the bottle fast enough that foam builds up, you know, that foam is coming from CO2 bubbles that, you know, nucleation sites have been formed, and you know, CO2 is coming out of solution, and you know, that'll produce foam, but it's also dropping your carbonation level. So yeah, if you a quick fill where you do what you described and push it very slowly, that's going to help. You would want to try to find the rate. You would want to fill the bottle as quickly as possible without foam.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be your best shot in that case.
Well, there you go. Everything that you need to know about winning competitions, except for all the stuff that we didn't talk about from the articles. So you still have to...
Except how to brew good beer.
You still have to go to the website, beerandwinejournal.com, to read the article. You're not getting out of it. You still have to, you still have to go read it. It's good stuff. There's a few, you know, sly and snide references in there that, you know, we haven't talked about.
What? Something snide in an article I wrote?
Surely not.
That doesn't seem right.
So uncharacteristic. All right, Chris. Once again, it's been fun, and it's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, always good to talk to you.
Well, thanks again to Chris. I don't go for competitions myself anymore, but I do admire and respect those who do enter and take home hardware, because some, you know, it's tough making. Making good beer, well, it's not tough making good beer, but it's, you know, you got to make good beer to begin with. And then, you know, there's all kinds of good beer competing at the same time. So if you can take home some hardware, win some medals, some ribbons, some plaques, some stuff, I think that's awesome. It's all in the name of better beer. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from and send in your disaster stories for the end of the year. Get them in quick so Steve and I can record the show. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too, as well as our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com, and take a look at our silicone pints, too, and tell Santa where to go. basicbrewingshop.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dunson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.